So from that witness to Master Siri, in very near proceeding, we have time to reach the subject. Let me introduce the events.
Thank you, Ernest. First of all, I'd like to offer my condolences to Madsen on a pathetic performance. And I would like to express my regret for coming as early as I did. I believe it was my research assistant told me that someone named Burke, I believe it was Kenneth Burke, the literary critic, once said that all that was necessary for the triumph of good was that evil men do nothing. I have attempted to base my activities on that axiom. And up until this evening, I have been satisfied that that was a correct premise. But after this display of energetic malice, I realize that I must arouse myself to greater effort. Madsen cannot really help behaving the way he did up here at this lectern. He remarked to me before the meeting that he has to be himself. And I said, yes, Madsen, I guess so. It's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it. Madsen remarked of his childhood experiences that that's a strange coincidence. My parents had told me about Madsen. They didn't want me to hear about him in the streets. With respect to our topic, I have experienced some hesitancy. I didn't know how to approach it. For the benefit of the Straussians in the audience, I had first wanted to conduct for my entire 12 minutes a close textual analysis of the resolution itself. But I experienced some difficulties. I did pretty well on the first operative word, house. It seemed to me that that made the resolution defective on its face. We are not in a house. We are in a hotel. I then ran up against some difficulty on the second operative word, which Don Lipset gave to me over the phone as enematize, which seemed to me to be unnecessarily vulgar for a meeting of this type. I abandoned that approach when I found out that that was a mistranslation. I then attempted the historical approach, beginning with pre-Socratics, and I got sort of lost in that pursuit. With all of the cognate elements of that time and this, did you know, for example, that there was a man named Heraclitus who actually said that no man could step in the same river twice? Can you imagine the pollution problem suggested by that observation? I finally abandoned that as well and decided that I would attempt to grapple with the argument posed by my opponent to the extent that he posed one. And it seemed to me that theoretically he was trying to exploit a contrast, an assumed contrast, between the alleged religious imperatives affirmed by the negative and the libertarian implications that have here been negated by the affirmative on this proposition. My view is that it is precisely the religious imperatives that are represented by my partner and myself that make any libertarian perspective possible. Our chairman, Dr. Vandenhag, has very eloquently, as usual, explained the meaning of the topic, and I was very happy to have it explained. It means, in essence, that the world is definable in terms of itself, that the goal of history lies within history rather than beyond it. It seems to me that that conspectus is necessarily hostile to the hope of human freedom, and in any review of the historical record, we can see that it has been hostile in two different ways. First, as it was affirmed by the ancients. Second, as it is affirmed by modernity, including our esteemed opponents. In the ancient view, the divine intention was interfused with physical nature. Indeed, physical nature itself was considered to be divine. And it was believed that the job of kings and emperors and other political authorities was to propitiate the deities in nature, to integrate society with the machinery of the cosmos, a perspective explained very eloquently by Henri Frankfort and Lucia Eliade and others. And I might note in passing that that integration of society with the cosmos was achieved without busting. The result of that point of view was that the political authorities were also religious authorities. There was a compact experience, political experience, as Bogman puts it. There was, in addition, no alternative authority or source of loyalty beyond the political state, because it was both religion and politics in one. And human life was in bondage to the cyclical rhythms of the natural order. In those circumstances, the idea of freedom, as we know it, was simply not conceivable. That view of existence was sundered by the advent of Judaism and Christianity, by the idea of transcendence, of a creator God who is not in nature, but the maker of nature, and above it, a creator God whose purposes for man lie beyond the rhythms of the cosmos, beyond the recurrent phenomena of the natural and the political order. It was from this de-immanentization of the eschaton that a number of libertarian consequences followed and created Western society and its freedoms as we know them. In the first place, as nature is desacralized, so is the political state. Its religious claims are drastically reduced. In the second place, the religious purpose that was formerly interfused with and compounded with the political power became a limiting principle above that political power. There was established as well an independent source of spiritual awareness in the person of the prophets and then institutionalized in the church, limiting and constraining the state. Beyond that, the individual person is exalted by the Judaic and Christian vision. There is an appeal to an authority and a criterion of intelligibility beyond the realm of politics. Human beings are released from their subjection to the cycles of the natural order. They are conceived as beings created in the image of the Creator God, possessed of an immortal, individuated soul. And the focus of this religious vision, in terms of human life, is on the drama of salvation, which is to be realized beyond this world, beyond the realm of history, and beyond the boundaries of the state. Now, there are other aspects of this vision as well, which I do not have time to detail. The notion of a public as opposed to an esoteric truth, the idea of linear time with a beginning, a middle, and an end beyond itself, the idea of the goodness of the created order coming from the Creator God, and the possibility of a volitional harmony among rational beings under a common rule of law, which is the root of the idea of the market. This is the source, the provenance of our freedoms. It is only in this tradition that human freedom as we know it and affirm it can flourish and has flourished. So the very libertarian enterprises that Dr. Curie would advance are possible only in the perspective that is represented here by the negative in this debate. The modern view, which Dr. Curie has in part represented this evening, is very similar to the pagan view from which we emerged with the advent of Judaism and Christianity. The pagans believed that the divine intention was interfused in nature and in the state, thus affirming the ultimacy of the political order. The moderns believe there is no divine intention, and therefore there is nothing beyond the visible realities of nature and the state. It also, therefore, affirms, for different reasons, the ultimacy of the political order. It is that particular conception which is the source of all of the authoritarian and totalitarian movements of this century and of other secular formulae for salvation, including liberalism and, apparently, curialism. From that point of view, there can be no opportunity for freedom. If one adopts that perspective, he immediately closes off once more, as did pagan antiquity, the alternatives, the openings through which human freedom can flourish, and the restraints on secular power that are derived from the notion of transcendence. And by making human history the measure of itself, denies the hope of intelligibility and the cause of freedom. Thank you.